When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2, Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. One of my favorite guests, Stephanie Barbe-Hammer. She is Professor Emerita of UC Riverside. Her books are funny and edgy and really smart, and there's always a magical border with them. They're always bordering the magical imagination. She's got a new novelette out that you're going to want to check out. It's called Rescue Plan. That's with Bamboo Dart Press. Today, Stephanie and I are covering Sansa. Sansa's her favorite character, and of course, I love to have people cover their favorite characters. The interview just gets so interesting for me, anyway. Steve and I cover episode 5 of season 5, Kill the Boy. And finally, in my bird's eye view section, I give you answers to that conundrum that I posed earlier. What do we do with the two different ways to create a knight in Westeros? I've got answers from Elio Garcia, from Carol Parrish Jameson. So stick around because I have the answers. Without further ado, here is Stephanie Barbe-Hammer.
Absolutely 100% correct. I am Team Sansa all the way.
Do you know other people like you? Because I think you're somewhat unique.
Well, thank you for saying that I'm somewhat unique. There are some of us out there. It's perhaps a somewhat smaller group, but it's a pretty passionate group of women, men, and non-binary folks.
Oh, very good. Very good. All right.
Or Sansa fans.
I want to hear about that. Now, so it sounds like Team Sansa is something like a perennial underdog.
Well, I'm not sure I'd put it that way. What I'm going to do is I'm going to quote the observation that my daughter made about Sansa. I'm not going to name my daughter. She prefers not to be named in these social media things.
Yeah.
But she said something like the following. She said, you know, Sansa is amazing because she is actually the one person in the book, in the books, who is operating according to courtly manners and courtly rules and regulations. And she's the one woman who totally does that. She has no special powers. She has no dragons. She is not a swordsman. She has her wits and the rules, spoken and unspoken, of the court. That's what she's got to work with.
Right. Well, okay, so here's our first problem, right? Because in many ways, these books are meant to subvert the kind of social norms that Sansa thinks are paramount. And not in every way, but in a lot of ways, Martin is basically trying to show that the mythology of, you know, gallantry and chivalry and all of the rules about what a knight looks like and fairy tales, that this is not the real world, and to believe that is naive, right?
So, Absolutely.
Sansa is sort of in a one down position from a lot of readers' perspectives.
Right. As all women were in the Middle Ages. She is absolutely the quintessential medieval woman. We think about Eleanor of Aquitaine. We think about the various princesses of France. They're all in the Sansa position, which is what I think makes her as a character all the more fascinating, because she has a sort of a historical contextual basis. And to come back to your point about Martin saying, well, here are all these mythoi and rules, but they don't work.
Right.
We see that operating precisely in the chapter that we're going to be talking about.
Excellent.
So I'm excited to do that.
All right. I'm going to do a brief synopsis of the chapter and we can get into it.
Great.
Okay. Here's my synopsis. Sansa is regaling Jane Poole with an account of her time at court. She's perplexed that her father did not send Loras to hunt down the mountain for his crimes. Jane suggests that Beric Dondarrion wasn't such a bad choice, but Sansa knows better. The two find a strawberry pie and gossip into the night. The next day, Sansa and Arya argue again over the Joffrey incident, and her sister ruins Sansa's silk dress. The older sister maintains as much dignity as she can on her way back to bed. Once alone, she cries herself to sleep and dreams of her dead direwolf lady. Then she is summoned by her father. Ned tells his two daughters that they must return to Winterfell. Sansa is convinced that this will ruin her life before it even begins. So, Stephanie Barbie-Hammer, do you want to talk about a character, a theme, a plot point, or shall you and I just climb the ladder of chaos?
Well, I think let's start with talking about the character, since I've already identified myself as a big
yes.
Sansa fan.
Good.
So let's maybe chat about that. What I love about this chapter is that she's very young. She's a young girl, and she's in some ways a silly young girl, as young girls often are. But we already in this chapter see that brain at work, see her noticing that difference that we just spoke about between what the myths and legends are supposed to be and what reality is, mm-hmm. between what people say they are and what they actually do. And that Sansa brain, those powers of perception are going on all the time. That we see that right at the beginning where she talks about how she really is a Sir Loras fan. And of course, who isn't? He's ridiculously handsome because he is physically one of old man stories
yes.
brought to life.
Yeah.
So technically he should be the perfect choice. So we see her going, well, here's the story. Here's the person.
Yeah.
He looks
yeah.
just like the story. So it should be him. And that is going to be debated shortly. Then we get a mention of Lord Baelish. And here's a great example of Sansa, young girl, sheltered girl, already going, something's wrong here. Baelish bows to her, and she doesn't like how deep the bow is.
yeah. She doesn't know whether she's being, what does it say?
Complimented or mocked.
Yes, complimented or mocked.
That's a perceptive person.
I'm going to read this little section here. I love that you brought this up. Lord Baelish stroked his little pointed beard and said, "Nothing. Tell me, child, why you would have sent Sir Loras." Sansa had no choice but to explain about heroes and monsters. The king's counselor smiled. "Well, those are not the reasons I would have given, but..." He had touched her cheek. His thumb lightly traced the line of a cheekbone. "Life is not a song, sweetly. You may learn that someday to your sorrow." Sansa did not feel like telling all that to Jane, however. It made her uneasy just to think back on it. So
Great.
she's thinking back on this this exchange she had with Baelish, but she wants to put it in the back of her mind, and she absolutely doesn't want to present that view of herself to Jane, who I think at the end of the day, she wants to impress Jane.
Yes, exactly. When, of course, she's more highly ranked. We're back to the middle, the medieval. She's more highly ranked than Jane Poole is. So it's a power dynamic that kind of messes with her status. But I think this is why Martin is such a fabulous writer. The other implication is that she doesn't like thinking about it again because she senses something's up with this. Something's wrong.
Right.
And is she right about this? Are her gut instincts fantastic?
I don't know about you, but I laughed so many times reading this chapter. This little section just got me. I'll read it here. It says, so Sansa is sort of recounting to Jane her experience observing court. Jane yawned. Are there any lemon cakes? Sansa did not like being interrupted, but she had to admit lemon cakes sounded more interesting than most of what had gone on in the throne room. Let's see, she said. The kitchen yielded no lemon cakes, but they did find half a cold strawberry pie, and that was almost as good. They ate it on the tower steps, giggling and gossiping and sharing secrets, and Sansa went to bed that night feeling almost as wicked as Arya.
Yeah.
I love that passage.
I do too. It's, again, a wonderful portrait of Sansa and her friend as girls.
Yeah, right.
And Jane saying, okay, this isn't so interesting. And Sansa, who's a cool enough kid to go, oh, but I'm talking. But yeah, you're right. It's really boring.
All right, now, okay, so we're going to find a little bit of friction here. This will be good. All right, I'm going to push back against Team Sansa. I think that she is horrible to Jane. I think that they're friends on a very superficial level, but I don't think Sansa really cares about Jane Poole. I think that she does feel herself superior to Jane Poole in a way that Arya never felt about Micah. You know, they definitely have a difference in social station, but Arya doesn't want to live by that kind of rule. And Sansa absolutely wants to live by that rule. So much so that when Jane says, you know, Beric is kind of handsome and I've got kind of a crush on Beric, Sansa thinks, this girl is a fool. There's no way that Beric would ever be with someone who is a steward's daughter. And she almost sort of, in her quiet self, believes that Jane is below her and naive.
However,
all right,
she doesn't say it. She thinks
true.
She doesn't say it. And again, I underlined this because I think it's quite important. Again, it's she does think she's superior.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably, in that world, she is in terms of rank.
Yeah.
And she's probably right about Lord Beric.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a kind thing to think, but it's an accurate thing to think, probably. And note, it would have been unkind to say so, however. So Sansa took a sip of milk and changed the subject. And again, that's courtly.
Yeah.
It's the book of the courtier, Castiglione, who was writing past the Middle Ages, but this is absolutely right out of Book of the Courtier.
Mm-hmm.
You cannot speak in an uncivil way to someone,
mm-hmm.
even though they are inferior to you in terms of their courtly rank. And again, it shows a certain kind of intelligence of understanding how those rules
work. Yeah, that's a good point. I just made the point recently that there's a difference between Tyrion's interior thoughts and what he will enact in the world, right? So he has these two voices that are both him, but he's learned to sort of not act on every inclination that he has. And I take your point about Sansa. She certainly does have that inner voice, but the way that she acts is different than her inclinations sometimes.
Right. And I love, Anthony, I love your bringing in Tyrion, because they certainly, I mean, at certain points become allies.
Right.
We'll see. And they share a certain, of course, he's incredibly smart and much older, but she is smarter than she looks,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
smarter than she acts sometimes. Because remember, she is a spoiled kid. But I think she's already here. We're seeing that gap between this is what I think, but that's not what I'm going to say. Very much unlike her dad. And this chapter is sandwiched in between two of Eddard Stark chapters.
Interesting. So you're saying that Ned has not learned this lesson that Sansa has learned pretty quickly.
Correct. She's already smarter politically in certain ways than he is.
Huh.
Because the chapter before this, we see him operating as the hand of the king.
Right.
And just motoring through those decisions, although there's all kinds of political stuff. You'll talk about it when you get to that chapter, of course. All kinds of political goings on. And Varys saying, sir, what about this? What about this? Shouldn't this problem, this mess up with the Holdfast and the murder of several people, shouldn't this be dealt with by local people? Isn't there another way to think about this? And Eddard just goes, nope, the king's justice, right. nope. And the next chapter is that very important conversation with Cersei about her kids and the parentage of her children.
Oh, that's right. That's
where
right.
He just goes, look, this is what's going to happen. This is what we're going to do. And she, you know, has her resonant line that I'm sure you'll discuss. You know, there's no middle ground with the Game of Thrones. You win or you die. That's it.
I wonder if there's something to be said here about someone's relative power in the kingdom in relationship to whether their inner voice can be their public voice. So I'm thinking, for instance, like Robert, who's the king, he can say whatever he wants with very little consequence. And
right.
Of course,
until the big consequence.
Right. Exactly. So there are consequences, it's just different consequences. But
yeah.
For instance, Ned as Hand of the King, if he feels like he needs to speak a hard truth, he just has to consider the consequences differently than someone like Sansa, who as a woman and a child, although a highborn child, the consequences for her speaking out of turn are much more severe than for someone like Ned.
Yes, I think that that's true. And she seems to, again, already glimpse that.
Yeah, yeah.
It's why she's so careful with Lord Baelish, even
right.
though she doesn't like what's going on, but she totally gets that she can't show that.
Right.
She can't. She's got to put up with him stroking her cheek and that other little creepy stuff that he does.
Right.
She'll have to put up with that.
Right. Whereas we were comparing Sansa to Tyrion or a little bit earlier, and you know, while Tyrion does have a different inner voice than the voice he presents, he does have a little bit more leeway to say what's on his mind and be more bawdy and, you know, just, you know, make jokes that it would be untoward to make. So his relative rank in the kingdom allows him a bit more freedom than someone like Sansa would have.
Absolutely. And he's male, even though he's a little person, he's male.
That's right.
So he has male privilege, which is crucial in this world. And Martin's very clear on that.
Yeah. Adult, male, and he's, if he's not very wealthy, at least his father is very wealthy and very powerful.
Right. He belongs to House Lannister, which is really the power, literally the power behind the throne.
Right.
He is going to, he has a certain amount of freedom that other people don't have.
I love that Sansa, this was another laugh point, but I love that Sansa is looking at Beric Dondarrion and thinking, yeah, he's fine, but he's so old. I mean,
yes,
he's like 22 years old. That's like ancient.
Yeah. And again, that's a wonderful reminder. Here we really see the artfulness of Martin's characterization. He never lets us forget that she's a kid.
Uh-huh.
She's you know, she's got the various flaws that we've been talking about. She's got the intelligence that I in particular have been stressing, but she's a kid. So she's going to eat that strawberry pie. And you know, she's, because what kid doesn't want a treat? There's no kid in the world that doesn't want a treat. And so, and the age comment reminds us, oh yeah, she's really young. She's a kid.
So Stephanie, this was the second reason why I wanted to cover this chapter with you. Because in your own work, you have really, to my mind, really captured the inner voice of the child really well in some of your characters. And
oh, thank you.
I think it's really difficult to do because it's like these children in the real world desperately want to be older than they are, right?
Yeah.
So they want to, they want, and they don't feel like they are, in general, they don't feel like they're too young to think over important issues. Although people might treat them younger, they feel like maybe they're misunderstood, and yet they're still immature. And it just seems like a really tricky thing to try to capture as an adult writing as a child. And I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about your own experience writing the inner voice of a child.
Oh, gosh. Thanks. Yeah, I do. I do write about kids and kids' points of view. The most recent book that I put out features a 15-year-old boy who is bicurious. And I have a novel coming out next spring, which is entirely the point of view of a 13-year-old girl. And it's interesting for me to think about that in conjunction with this conversation, because I'm wondering if the Sansa character hasn't influenced me in certain ways as a writer. Mm. And so that's the cool thing to realize. But I think that one of the things that I think about when I write kids' points of view, and I imagine Martin thinks about this too, or has incorporated this idea, is remember that the notion of childhood is a modern one.
Oh, yeah.
The whole idea of the child as a separate kind of person who has a very different inner life and a whole set of developmental stages that have to be ministered to, that's 18th century. And of course, the person who really writes about this is Jean-Jacques Rousseau, wrote these important books about education. But so the child as this very particular kind of individual doesn't exist in the Middle Ages. Your offspring are small and then they get bigger and you train them to do adult things as soon as they're big enough to do them. Particularly if we're thinking about farm work and so on, but even horsemanship and swordsmanship and these other things for the women, sewing and certain kinds of, activities that require fine motor skills. So as soon as your offspring has the motor skills to do that, they learn how to do it. So keeping that in mind, I write my kids' points of view as though they thought they were fully cognizant people who are able to comment the world, and they don't reflect so much on the fact that they are kids, although my heroine in this novel coming up does do that occasionally, but that's because she's neurodivergent and thinks a bunch of different thoughts at the same time.
Okay, that's really, actually, it's really helpful when viewing this book, because I think a lot of times my own inner voice is a little bit critical, like, if this is how someone would treat their child, or, you know, for instance, famously Ned bringing his 8-year-old son to a beheading, that kind of thing.
Right.
So what you're saying is really helpful to me. Absolutely. It's helpful. At the same time, from a psychological perspective, you know, we know that the human mind doesn't develop isn't fully developed, you know, it could, you know, until 25, really. So how do you incorporate that part of it?
Yeah, I'm smiling as you're talking, because, of course, you know, the thinking about kids, it explains a lot of the Middle Ages, doesn't it? Because we have all these people who become kings at 12.
Right.
Well, no wonder. Right? No wonder it's a catastrophe.
Yeah, their nobility is so much more important than sort of their life stage, I suppose.
Right. So you have very, very, very young people with tremendous amounts of power. And again, the character of Joffrey, who we're not supposed to talk about because that's a different chapter, but he's a wonderful example of, oh my gosh, this is why you don't put kids in charge, you know, ever, because
it could go really wrong. I mean, it can go really wrong with adults too, but Joffrey's a great example of this.
Right, 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 right. So, but it makes me think of that book. What is it? It's Barbara Tuchman, A Distant Mirror, which is about 14th century Europe, and is just if everybody, most people die at 30,
right?
You know, then people, you know, somebody like Bran, you know, he might be expected to take over at 10 years old.
Sure.
He's eight, but it could happen. So he needs to know what a beheading looks like.
Yeah.
Because he may have to do one or have someone help him do one at 10.
Okay. So then the other part of this question was, sort of Martin famously has brought to us so many interesting female characters. And yet he's a male, first and foremost. I wonder, what's your experience with women characters written by men?
Oh, that's a great question. I think it, of course, depends on the author. And I think some men write women characters fantastically well. I think Martin does a remarkably good job with his characters. And I don't think we're probably not supposed to talk about the TV show at all. But I think he, as an author, is more successful than the TV series is.
Well, with Sansa,
showing nuance.
Yeah, with Sansa in particular, I think that that's true. I think that because we don't hear that inner voice, and this is just the problem with, you know, television, I suppose, because
yes.
we just don't hear that inner voice with complexity, it's impossible to know how much Sansa is observing and making decisions, where
right.
we just see what she says and how she, you know, how
right.
she looks. And for the most part, I think that they just portrayed Sansa as sort of an immature, well, in all of the ways that Peter Baelish and the Hound and Ned view Sansa, that's kind of how we, the viewers, view her.
Mm-hmm. Although the actor, I think, really pushes against that and does wonderful things with that portrayal. I think actually all the female actors are great. But yeah, back to the inner voice question. I think that that's a crucial aspect to the kind of characterization that Martin is doing. And arguably the Daenerys character in the books is more effective too, because we can see what's going on in her head and all of the things she's thinking about. As opposed to just seeing her, you know, meet the dragons and so on.
Sure.
We have much more of a sense of a complex and layered inner life. Again, I think that that's something that Martin is very good at. It's one of the reasons why I, as a literary writer who write predominantly magical realism, really enjoy him as a popular literature writer, because he has all of these very sophisticated characterization techniques that he's able to seed through a chapter. And we've just been talking about a few of them in this one. So the difference between Sansa's inner voice and what she actually says, the continual reminders that she is a kid, and these setups where we see her negotiating sort of class and privilege power dynamics.
Here's an example of the inner voice again. "I didn't do anything wrong," Sansa pleaded with him. "I don't want to go back." She loved King's Landing, the pageantry of the court, the high lords and the ladies in their velvets and silks and gemstones, the great city with all of its people. The tournament had been the most magical time in her whole life, and there was so much she had not seen yet. Harvest feasts, masked balls, and mummer shows. She could not bear the thought of losing it all. "Send Arya away. She started it, Father. I swear I'll be good. You'll see. Just let me stay and I'll promise to be fine and noble and courteous as the queen." All right, so you hear an example of the voice she's using with her father, but then her inner voice is all about how she's fallen in love with King's Landing.
Yes.
And you don't learn till the next paragraph that it hasn't occurred to her in the slightest to think about missing Joffrey. And so the
it hasn't.
Right.
That's a great point. That's a wonderful point.
So
yes.
I was just thinking, she absolutely has fallen in love with the idea of being a great lady at court.
Yeah.
She is not in love with Joffrey.
No, I think that that's a fantastic observation. The other thing I think I'd just add on to this is what we see here, I'm not sure we see it for the first time, but we certainly see it in a very, very clear and passionate way, a young girl's longing for the larger world. Hmm. She does not live in a large world. And again, we're back to the situation of women who lived very constricted lives in the Middle Ages. And so the larger world that they could live in is a world that they could observe and watch. And she wants that so passionately and so sincerely. And it's, we feel, or I feel as a woman reader, I feel her desire for that larger world. I get it. I understand. Although I, as a reader, already have tremendous doubts about King's Landing. I get why she wants to stay.
Yeah. She views Winterfell as this cold and gray place where they're going to lock her away forever. That's not really true. I mean, it may be cold and gray, but she's absolutely privileged in Winterfell.
Absolutely. But unfortunately, the things that Winterfell has to offer her, those qualities and capabilities are at this point not things that she values.
Right.
And that's her immaturity showing and her overly privileged worldview showing that she doesn't appreciate those things.
So notable introductions in this chapter. This is a category we usually do just to call them out as we see them for the first time. I didn't see any. I think this is the first chapter where I don't see like a new character introduced. We don't see, a new object. We could point to the strawberry pie, but it's like it's not nearly as interesting as some of the other introductions. And I suppose it is that we're far enough along in this book that you don't necessarily need to keep introducing new concepts. It could be that the job of world building has basically been done for this particular novel.
Yeah. Well, yes, you're right. There are no new characters introduced here. And that is interesting because there's so many characters in this world.
Yeah.
Martin is continually having to very skillfully create these exposition paragraphs and chapters so he can get all of these people on stage. Right. He's just got a cast of thousands, right, literally. But I do think that, again, this is why, female readers have some use. The dress is crucial.
Oh, all right.
The spoiled dress that the queen gave her.
Sure.
So it's the mark. It's a beautiful, expensive gift, but it's also a mark of power.
Yes. The dress represents her engagement to Joffrey.
Right. And her eventual access to the queenly station, because the queen has given the dress to her.
Yes.
And it's spoiled, and that is really a harbinger of woe.
Right. Okay. So, and it's exactly Arya who spoils it, right? It's this unfortunate tension that the two girls still have over this, over an understandably traumatic experience. Mm-hmm. Arya. Well, I guess you could say both girls learn that their father is not all powerful, right? The father can't solve the problem.
Yeah.
And both girls lose their wolf, in different ways, but they lose the wolf. And this becomes a rift for them. And of course, so Arya is appropriately the one that spoils the dress.
Yeah. But I want to come back to the wolves because we've been talking a little bit about the Middle Ages and women. The dire wolf lady is the innocent victim.
Yeah.
And the perfectly behaved wolf, the wolf who eats daintily from Sansa's hand.
Right.
And that's, again, Martin's wonderful, brilliant way of saying, uh-oh, look what happened to Lady. What's going to happen to her owner?
Okay, I want to talk about Lady too. So in this chapter, After the dress is spoiled, she holds herself upright, does not cry in public. She walks back to her bedroom. She cries herself to sleep. And then when Septa Mordain comes to collect her, halfway between waking, she has this sort of little half dream of Lady looking at her.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
Isn't that a fascinating little weird moment?
Yeah.
Again, as a magical realist, I love this kind of thing. It's like, you know, is it a real spirit or is it a dream,
right,
or is it, you know? But I think it's just that little reminder of what happened to the dire wolf. And it's, as I was trying to kind of indicate, and you've given me a great entree, it's Martin's little foreshadowing. Here's what happened to one lady.
Yeah.
What's going to happen to this one, the one who's the dreamer?
Sure.
What's going to happen to her?
Yeah.
Because things do not seem to go well for the innocent and the perfectly behaved.
Right. Yeah. When she realizes that it's a dream, I think the text says, and then Lady was dead again.
Yes.
Yeah. So for a moment, yeah, Lady was alive with her.
Yeah.
And she
yeah.
has that connection. I
yeah.
mean, sometimes I view these direwolves as sort of the Starkish identity. You know how, like, sometimes, like, Frodo will embrace his Tookish side?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he feels adventurous and he's like, you know,
yes.
he's sort of living into his Tookish identity over
right.
against
it's
his Baggins.
The other side of the family coming out.
Right,
yeah,
right,
yeah,
right.
yeah.
Sometimes I view these wolves as, you know, they're connected to these characters to ground them or anchor them
mm-hmm.
back in their Stark or Winterfell identity.
Yes.
And
yes.
I always viewed Lady's departure as, well, Sansa's now adrift. She's lost her anchor. She's a woman in King's Landing now. She's not a Stark.
Oh, I think that's a great point. She's lost her grounding.
Yeah.
And she seems to sense that because she's noticing things, but not noticing things and trying to do what's necessary, but having these sort of weird sort of second thoughts
mm-hmm.
that come
mm-hmm.
in about and feeling these nagging doubts about things, nagging doubts about Lord Baelish, what's his story. And again, another moment in this wonderful chapter of she notices but doesn't quite put two and two together
mm-hmm.
is her resonant remark that Joffrey looks nothing like his father.
Right. Yes. I think that's the key. I think that's sort of the key moment of the chapter.
Yeah.
Because yeah. Sansa sees very clearly that Joffrey is a lion and not a
yes.
stag, right?
Yes.
And
yes.
it has taken Ned forever to
yeah.
realize what that means, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
so he says, out of the mouth of babes, it's sort of Ned's aha moment.
Yes.
But he needed Sansa's eyes to have the aha moment.
Right. Because he's not perceptive like she is. Again, back to that her
yeah, yeah.
chapter being sandwiched between the two Eddard Stark chapters. He's such a good person
mm-hmm.
and an honest person, but he is not politically astute, and he is weirdly non-perceptive in certain ways. Probably goes back to your comments, because he could afford to be. He hasn't had to be
right.
that perceptive in that way. And he's a soldier. So he's got those wonderful instincts and abilities. But perception and noticing people and noticing things, that he's not so great at.
Mm-hmm. Well, Steph, I knew you were the perfect person. When I read this chapter, I was thinking, oh, I've got to get Steph back on to talk about.
Yay, I'm so happy that I could come back. It's been such a pleasure to discuss it with you, Anthony.
Likewise.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints, Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of bald movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I cover Kill the Boy. This is Season 5, Episode 5. We've got Bloodsport and Marine. Stannis at the Wall and Sansa back at Winterfell, but under new management. Just a word about Steve. Steve is going to be doing a set at Cobb's Comedy in San Francisco in the next week. He's going to be hosting for Kevin Nealon, so I'm sure that's going to be a magnificent show. As always, you can find out more details by following Steve on Instagram at OzFest. That's at AUSFEST. Here is comic Steve Osborne.
Steve, have you ever had a debilitating skin condition that drove you crazy and made you murderous?
I don't recall. I got a bug bite once in a weird spot. Eyebrow.
Were you with our mutual friends when one of them got a leech on his junk?
No, I was not.
All right. Okay. I was a different group of people.
Yeah.
Also, Stand By Me.
Yes.
It happened in real life and on Stand By Me.
And Game of Thrones.
And Game of Indeed. You know what, Steve? I don't think I've got anything bad to say about this episode. I just finished watching it.
Okay.
Like right before we got on. And I mean, very, very mildly, I'm still yawning a little bit at the Grey Worm Missandei love.
Sure. Plot. Yeah.
But aside from a yawn, I mean, this episode was fantastic.
So we've had a couple of these.
You know, this episode had zero Dorne, right?
Zero
Dorne.
And that, so you wonder, so like taking a quick look back, I mean, we're on episode 5 of this season, the much maligned season 5. If you subtract the Dorne narrative, I think you have a decent season, right? I mean, I don't think we've had anything. I mean, we've had some like you said, questionable, like, I don't know if Barristan's death really matters a whole lot, but I mean, that's, you know, that's okay.
I think so far, I mean, let's say we're halfway through season five. So far, there was maybe one dog of an episode.
Yeah.
And it probably did just relate to the Dorne stuff.
Right.
You know, I don't, the stuff that's going on with Arya is kind of a slow build at this
yeah.
point. Not quite yeah. as exciting as her and the Hound murdering dudes on the road, right?
Well, definitely is testing my, I think, earlier statement where I'm just like, I can, you know, it give me any Arya subplot and I'm in. This is definitely going to put that to the test, I think, because I feel like we've come a long way with it. But here's where, you know, my concerns are, right? I mean, and I keep asking, like, where are we at compared to the book? And, you know, you keep mm-hmm. saying we're diverging more and more. So then we start going into territory where I'm like, okay, now I have to trust the showrunners that they are in tune with these characters enough that the arc that they're going to give them mm-hmm. Is going to feel satisfying, and they're not going to mm-hmm. undo any of the work. And I think we've had some of those questions already with Sansa, right? Is I feel like we keep getting these false starts.
Mm-hmm. All the stuff at Winterfell is not happening in the books at all.
Right.
So that's all made up. Most of the stuff that's happening at the Wall is really true to the books.
Okay.
And a couple characters are a little different here and there, but I guess, you know what? There is one thing at the Wall that is a little interesting, in that there's a little bit more magic going on. Mance Rayder doesn't die.
Okay. Well, that seems pretty big.
Do you remember that guy, Lord of Bones?
Oh yeah.
You know, good old Lord of Bones.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess, Melisandre was able to glamour those two into separate bodies or something, or at least it made them look like they had swapped bodies. And so the guy that they burned alive was actually Lord of Bones.
What was the rationale for that?
Well, they wanted to keep Mance around, but they wanted to show that, you know, if you're not going to kneel before the king, then you get burned or something like that.
Gotcha.
So they killed Lord of Bones, and then they glamoured Mance Rayder into Lord of Bones' bone armor.
Oh, okay. So he becomes Skeletor.
He becomes Skeletor, that's right. The stuff with Danny, it's similar. It's similar to what's going on. The big deal about the fighting pits.
So the fighting pits is in the book?
Fighting pits is in the book, and also the dragons not being controllable, that's also right. in the book.
Okay. I think if I'm going to take one exception of just not understanding why Marines got to have their sports, man.
You of all people should know that if you take sports out of a culture, people get really bored and upset.
I guess. I mean, it just seems like a very odd thing to focus on, because
they got fantasy leagues, they got betting circles.
I guess the question for me is,
Stephen A. Smith has a big talk show in Marine.
Would we as a society feel the need to have fantasy sports if we lived in a fantasy realm?
Yeah.
I mean, right. I don't know. I mean, I'm just
we
like,
would have a fantasy dragon league. It would be whole thing.
I mean, here's the deal. Like, I could see it being like, hey, we really want to turn the dungeon where your dragons are into a zoo. I think it'd be good for everyone.
Yeah, the kids would love it.
Yeah, people could go see dragons in a zoo. But no, it's like there's dragons on the premises and everyone's like, nah, I kind of want to watch a couple guys fight. I just feel like things have shifted, man. I mean, it's like this whole idea, like, well, we got to keep our traditions. It's like, dude, there's dragons.
I think that you're underplaying the blood sport, like just the absolute thrill of a blood sport. Risking our lives in order to have these sports.
Oh, no. We are risking athletes' lives.
It's true. Yeah, that's
to be
true.
Clear, we're not risking anything.
Yeah, this is blood sport. That's exactly what's happening.
I guess this is what it is, right? I mean, I guess if there was, I don't know. I mean, maybe it just seems like a weird thing with all the other stuff going on, you know, crucifixions, beheadings, and everyone's like, yeah, but like, come on, bring back the pits.
You're describing 2020 America. That's
I guess saying. I am. I guess I am. This was Martin's ahead of his time.
Yeah, we know that there's a global pandemic. Give us our football. All right. Hey, I loved almost everything about this. I loved all of the intrigue at the wall with, you know, do you bring in the wildlings?
The wall is great. The wall is all about. I'm all about the wall. And I didn't think, I didn't think I was going to be in that spot. But
I kind of, you have this feeling about this kid, Ollie, who's just lost his parents. You're like, that guy's got a good point.
Yeah.
That's got, how can you not have that opinion? And of course, if you're Jon Snow, you're like, well, yeah, but they're better than zombies trying to eat our brains. Right.
Right. Which is a fascinating concept. I mean, I really think that this is a great notion that we've seen in graphic novels like Watchmen, for example, right? It's the idea of an other we can all agree on, right? And it's
sure.
And so when you're dealing with like an undead army, it's hard to be like, well, we'll go negotiate. Like, you realize this is not going to happen. So
again, 2020 America. It's like there is a global pandemic. And we're like, yeah, but I really hate that guy a lot. So I'm not going to agree with that guy on the global pandemic.
Right. No, that's fair.
I loved all that. I love that Stannis is a grammarian. Like,
that was amazing.
They're literally arguing about like undoing 8,000 years of tradition. He's like, it's not less. It's fewer.
It's fewer. Yeah. Luz has 1-0.
I love
there
that.
There is no irregardless.
All right. So what's one thing that worked for you in this episode?
Well, almost anything, like I said, almost anything with the wall. I'm super, super into, was quite taken by the addition of grayscale.
Well, like, yeah, that was sort stone. Of the big thing at the end, the stone men, right?
The stone men. Yeah. Like that.
Are there any stone women?
That's a great question. I don't know. I assume they're
it's just a boys back, club.
Yeah, they're back preparing, all the fixings for if they're going to have a dwarf dinner, I guess. So the stone men, well, they're the stone men, I guess, is the intent to just go and what are they doing? Like, they go and I realize that they live here and it's not great.
Well, yeah, they like to attack people. And then make more stone men.
Is that their main goal? Is just
I don't think they have a goal. It's sort of like this instinctual, like they revert to their lizard brain and
they've gone mad, right? Is that the
idea?
They've
gone mad.
Yeah. So they've gone mad, but are they going to eat them? Or are they going to just turn them into
again? We have not met stone women. This society may be a lot better if there was any women in leadership,
right? Or the women are just like, look, send out the stone men. They're dummies. Just look, they want to go. This day they were my husband's screaming about a boat with a dwarf, so I say go get it.
I love that was a great way to end. And you know what was great for me is to see Tyrion's reaction to seeing Drogon in the sky.
Yeah, that
like
was
how
awesome.
Many times have I seen a dragon in the show, but seeing him encounter the dragon
and what it means, right, and what it means for the landscape of everything they're doing, right?
Yeah,
He's heard about this woman with dragons, right? And he's headed towards there, but there seems to be like, I'm sure there's skepticism on all of it, right?
It's a little bit like he's the top scientist in his field and he sees a nuclear plume for the first time.
Yeah.
And realizes nothing is going to be the same after this. So I love that. And so you're kind of like high on that little thrill. And then just beyond his shoulder, if you look just behind him, you see this creepy guy standing.
Yeah, that whole sequence was very well, speaking of direction, that was very well directed.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I loved it. All right, you had a question about the stone men?
I guess I was just asking about, like, what their motives are.
Just think they like to scratch people.
Yeah, so they touch them. They just touch them, right? Is that it? It's...
Like the Midas touch?
It's, yeah, only worse.
I don't know. It's a good question.
I mean, is it a scratch? Is it a bite? Because, I mean, they're pulling Tyrion down, and I guess it's because he's touching his clothes, but he never got an ankle, huh?
It's a cooties thing.
I guess it is.
We were, like, dealing with sort of really primal taboos like incest and cannibalism.
Nobody's touching cooties, I guess.
Yeah, cooties is one of the most primal taboos, Steve. all right, but that is not my favorite part of this show.
Okay.
I loved when Sansa encounters Theon. And she kind of sees him for the first time. I think that there's a whole range of emotion, like it's kind of our surrogate brother.
Right.
And she's totally alone, and yet she believes that this guy killed her brothers, and he just looks horrid. And then he says, you shouldn't be here. And to me, that kind of had the vibe of like, she's in a haunted house and there's a voice that says, get out.
Yeah. Yeah.
For me, that was sort of like a little portent, like you have no idea what you're about to undergo in this place.
Right.
I think that because Sansa and Theon may be in the same boat at this point, and because there's something she doesn't know, that he didn't really kill Bran and Rickon.
Right.
That you've sort of got this possible alliance there that neither one of them would have chosen in any other situation.
This is the closest thing right now that she would have as an ally. And he's a pretty, pretty damaged ally if he's going to be one.
Oh, so he's the most damaged psychologically.
And physically, yeah, not great.
It's almost like every scene that Ramsay's in with him is psychological torture. Like even if something is horrible isn't happening, even Ramsay sort of reaching out his hand and saying, "I forgive you."
Yeah, we were both like, yeah, and then that was it. We're like, huh?
Even that's psychological torture.
Yeah.
Ramsay's like he's like Pigpen, but instead of the cloud that goes with him wherever he goes, it's just the air of torture goes with him.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, a very special isn't your speed. We've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts. We try to make it super easy to support making podcasts at Bald Move. Just join the club. But some people aren't a joining type, or maybe they're already in the club but want to add a little bit of gratuity for an especially great season of coverage, or for a podcast that really spoke to them or gave them that bit of support in a tough time.
For these, and for whatever other reason you might have, our tip jar is always open. Head over to support.baldmove.com and click the donate option to say, hey, keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it.
Once again, check out support.baldmove.com for all the great ways to help me and Jim keep making the podcast you love.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I'd like to follow up on the question I posed to you a couple weeks ago about how knights are made in Westeros. Just to recap, there seems to be this idea that any knight can make a knight, and we see this in a few different iterations of the show and the book canon. And yet, we also have this idea that the ceremony by which a knight becomes a knight involves the faith of the seven and septons and seven oils, etc., etc. So, how do we deal with that discrepancy? Well, I put out a few emails, and I got a couple that I thought were really helpful. The first is from Carol Parrish Jameson. My thanks to Carol for permission to read her email on the podcast. So Carol writes, Martin's concept of knighthood certainly seems to draw from a wide geography and history, but it does roughly reflect what I've learned about the institution. As I understand it, particularly in the early Middle Ages, any senior knight can bestow the honor on another. However, social rank was always an important element. So I don't think it's exactly true that any knight could make a knight in the actual Middle Ages, unless those involved were of high rank. Medieval chivalric manuals make it clear that only certain individuals are fit for knighthood. So I don't know if Davos the Onion Knight would have been as easily dubbed in reality. However, it did happen that lower classes could penetrate the noble ranks through the acquisition of money and ultimately by titles. The medieval fablo frequently target this kind of knight who lacks proper birthright generally, and in this comic genre, fails at chivalry. I've always been under the impression that in certain instances, such as wartime, knighthood could be granted out of necessity, with less regard to rank and probably less ceremony. I thought this was a great answer to it because it shows you that the context really matters here. In most contexts, one's social rank is of crucial importance. And yet, during times of warfare, it could be that you needed more knights, and so some of the ideals could be overlooked. Interestingly enough, I got an email from Evan, who's in the Air Force, and he says that it's much the same in the modern world, that ceremonies for promotion usually involve lots of pomp and circumstance for higher-ups. And while there are manuals for how to promote really everyone in the Air Force, sometimes you overlook these depending on context. Carol's email continues, as the concept of chivalry evolved, the ceremony of knighting became more elaborate, and the institution of knighthood became more closely associated with class and rank. The Crusades surely solidified the religious aspects of dubbing. I think Carol's insights are very much in keeping with Martin's style as an author of creative medievalism. He really does like to push eras together. As we saw with the weaponry that the knights use, sometimes he will grab a detail from the early Middle Ages and he will put that with a more modern detail. And it very well could be that he's pushed together various elements of knighthood from various geography and various time periods. So maybe we have a partial explanation. And now to my email with Elio Garcia. Elio writes, the distinction between the two ways of making a knight is simply a matter of formality and, to some degree, class. So we see a parallel here with Carol's email. A nobleman will be a page, then a squire, and then there will be a formal visual and anointing followed by a dubbing by the knight they have served, or the lord or king, or what have you. That is the usual path, which is very much a class one. The any knight can make a knight mantra generally refers to the less formal circumstance of a knight dubbing someone else in an expedient way. Someone who may not even be of nobility or hasn't gone through the formal process of training for knighthood. This can leave people sneering at the knight. They could be someone like Dunk, an impoverished hedge knight with no witness to his dubbing, or Sir Glendon Flowers, a base-born bastard, who was knighted in exchange for his sister's virginity. In both forms, though, someone who is believed to have been able to convey knighthood, another knight, a king, etc., is involved. Septons can anoint you and bless you, consecrating you in the seven as a part of the formal ritual, but they don't dub you with the sword or give you the accolade. So Elio's answer gives us a few bits of supporting evidence, but the thing that he adds that I did not know that I am very appreciative of is that it is absolutely crucial for the dubbing to be done by, let's call this person a secular representative, like a king or a knight. And in that sense, any knight can indeed make a knight. But ideally, that ceremony will also involve a septon to bring in the religious element. Finally, I ought to mention that I made a mistake in my previous Bird's Eye View where I was asking about Braun because it seemed very vague about how Braun was knighted. Braun was sort of my entree into the topic. But BW from Brisbane writes that in Storm of Swords, in Tyrion's first chapter, Braun says, and I quote, "We got ourselves dabbed by the High Septon and dubbed by the Kingsguard. Took half the bloody day, with only three of the white swords left to do the honors." So that little detail suggests that absolutely Braun did go through that religious ceremony. Even so, I think that Elio's email really solves the problem for us. Can any knight really make a knight? Well, yes and no. Class distinctions are still very important. And ideally, you are going to want a religious ceremony. But in less than ideal circumstances, yeah, any knight can indeed make a knight. So it seems like we have a ceremonial ideal, and then we have the general acceptance of lesser ceremonies. Of course, anything that falls short of the ideal is subject to social ridicule. If you have any more thoughts on this, email book@baldmove.com. Again, my thanks to Evan, thanks to BW, my thanks to Carol Parrish Jameson, and my thanks to Elio Garcia. And that is all for this week.